And of course, those trombones means it's birthday time here in Iris. We have two birthdays we're celebrating on this March 5th. Francis Oleson of Des Moines and Jim Bright of Vinton. So Francis and Jim, very happy birthday to both of you on this March 5th. You are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. If you're hearing us on your television and Iowa PBS and you're not a registered IRIS user, please give us a call at 515-243-6833 so we can get you on our list. We need to know who's listening in order to keep our services free. Now we will turn to Deanna for today's obituaries.
Thank you, Pat. Dennis Ray Wright, age 75, of Des Moines, Iowa, died in his home of lung cancer on March 3, 2024. He was born in Sheraton, Iowa, to his parents, Lee and Dorothy Wright. Dennis was a hobbyist of many sorts, which included gas boats, airplanes, and repairing old cuckoo clocks. He loved listening to his oldies music while sitting in his 1948 Plymouth that he was so proud of. Dennis Wright was survived by his wife, Patricia Wright, and is survived by his four children, Ashley Wright, Melissa Wright, Travis Wright, Terry Thompson, his five grandchildren, Lily Wright, Liam Warren, Hadley Warren, Jordan Thompson, Casey Thompson, and his nephew, David Barry, and his sister, Eloise McGuire. No service will be held at this time. Philip Richards of Pleasantville. A funeral service for Philip Richards, age 94, of Pleasantville, will be held Thursday, March 7th at 10:30 a.m. at Mason Funeral Home. Burial with military honors will follow in Pleasantville Cemetery. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to the Pleasantville American Legion Post number 108, or to the Pleasantville Christian Church. Online condolences may be left at burtonfuneralhomes.com. Philip was a Korean War veteran and had farmed in the Pleasantville area all of his life. He is survived by his niece, Julie, married to Pat Wilkinson, and a host of cousins and friends. David Fisher, age 75, passed away on February 25th in West Des Moines. He was born July 24, 1948, in West Des Moines, to his parents, Tom and Rose Fisher. David grew up in Valley Junction. He worked for the Iowa Power, Mid-American Energy, and Par Electric for many years. He was a proud member of IBEW Local 55. He enjoyed many years of riding his Harley-Davidson. After retirement, he enjoyed working outside and taking his dog Winnie for walks. David also enjoyed cheering on the Chicago Bears and the Iowa Hawkeyes. Most of all, he cherished his time with his fans and his family. David is survived by his son, Dalton Lee Fisher Beauchamp, and other loving families and friends. He is preceded in death by his parents, five sisters, and two brothers. Memorial contributions may be made to A. Hines 57 Animal Shelter in loving memory of David Fisher. A celebration of life will be planned at a later date. Online condolences may be made at hamiltonsfuneralhome.com. Pat.
Thank you, Deanna. And we'll continue now with the 50 states, starting with Arizona and Phoenix. The Navajo Nation is nearing completion of a settlement of water rights claims in Arizona, ending decades of negotiations and giving hope for thousands of people who have long gone without running water. From Conway, Arkansas, a Louisiana man was arrested in Conway on an outstanding warrant for second-degree murder and possession of a firearm by a convicted felon. From Redding, California, after years of planning, delays, and approvals, dirt could start moving for construction of Dignity Health's $70 million Regional Cancer Center later this year. Dignity Health Northern California Division spokeswoman said that they are working on finishing the construction documents phase of the project, and when that's done, they will submit the plans to the City of Redding's Building Department. In Pueblo, Colorado, security cameras, footage, and witness statements led to the arrest of three men last month in connection with the late June 2023 homicide of Jordan Robinson, according to the Pueblo Police Department. In Norwich, Connecticut, Lieutenant Governor Susan Bishewich joined local officials to highlight the $8,707,755 recently awarded to the town of Griswold through the Community Investment Fund The money will be used for a municipal water infrastructure project. In Wilmington, Delaware, newly released data from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services sheds light on emergency room visit lengths in Delaware and how the first state compares with the rest of the country. By hospital, between April 2022 and March 2023, the data show that St. Francis Hospital in Wilmington had the shortest emergency room visit lengths in Delaware. Bay Health Hospital, Kent Campus in Dover, had the longest. From our nation's capital, officials there said a man has been arrested in connection with a deadly stabbing in 2022. Pensacola, Florida, if you gave people the chance to describe last year's summer in one word, a good chunk of the population would probably tell you the same thing. It was hot. And they would be right. Last year was the warmest year in modern temperature record, which dates back to 1850, according to National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. On average, Florida ranked as the hottest state in the United States with an average temperature of 74.1 degrees over the past 15 years. In Savannah, Georgia, designed for a potential apartment complex aimed to house displaced families, received approval from the Historic Preservation Commission, providing the board's approval that the potential building matches the neighborhood's character. From Honolulu, Representative Bertrand Kobayashi announced that he will retire when his term is up in November after nearly three decades as a lawmaker. From Boise, Idaho, a new bill would require counties to create ordinances that protect farmland from development, according to Boise State Public Radio. Springfield, Illinois, if Governor J.B. Pritzker has his way, a 30-year pension funding initiative of a Republican predecessor would be no more. The Pritzker team discussed how to reform the plan, commonly known as the Edgar Ramp, prior to the governor's delivery of the budget proposal. And from Indiana and Bloomington, the Kinsey Institute will remain at Indiana University and not be transformed into a 501c3 nonprofit after university administration changed course and asked the Board of Trustees to pursue accounting solutions to keep the Sex Research Center at the school. Deanna?
Out of Des Moines, Iowa, a Des Moines man is soon to be posthumously recognized for his role in a top-secret troop designed to confuse and intimidate the Germans in World War II. Out of Topeka, Kansas, a Topeka building described by the Kansas Historical Society as one of the last remaining important architectural structures from the pre-World War I time period of Topeka is now on the market. Out of Louisville, Kentucky, modular homes designed to be built more quickly and affordably than traditional construction could soon begin rolling out of a new manufacturing facility in Louisville's Parkland neighborhood. MMY Global announced plans to invest $6.1 million in the facility, creating 73 full-time jobs, with more expected as production ramps up. Out of Lafayette, Louisiana, after an unprecedented drought, the Louisiana Department of Agriculture and Forestry is asking the federal government to aid Louisiana's crawfish industry. The drought in 23 was one of the most severe droughts in the history of Louisiana and caused significant damage to the sustainability of the crawfish industry. Out of Sanford, Maine, a newly formed coalition is dedicating itself to attracting and training thousands of workers for critical jobs in the defense industry in Maine, including Portsmouth Naval Shipyard. From Salisbury, Maryland, a sponsor of legislation that is now being considered by the Maryland General Assembly and designed to protect residents' privacy online called the current data environment in the United States, quote, almost like the Wild Wild West, unquote. From Brockton, Massachusetts, the state's Department of Elementary and Secondary Education will conduct a safety audit for all Brockton public schools, including Brockton High, said Mayor Robert Sullivan. The announcement comes as schools across the district are struggling with physical violence, drug use, and other security and safety issues, and four school committee members are calling for the U.S. National Guard to step in. Out of East Lansing, Michigan, Michigan State University officials announced that they have begun the process of releasing long-withheld documents on the school's investigation into convicted sexual abuser Larry Nassgar to the Michigan Attorney General's office. From Onamia, or is it Onamia, Minnesota? Not sure. Construction on a $50,000 or 50,000 square foot cannabis growing facility has begun on Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe tribal lands near Onamia, NPR News reported. Out of Jackson, Mississippi, a bill making its way through the Mississippi Senate could shutter the state's 123-year-old penitentiary at Parchment by 2023. Out of Columbia, Missouri, a graduate-level course at Missouri University of Science and Technology focused on artificial intelligence is being taught by a team of working professionals. Pat.
Thank you, Dana. Continuing, we look at Billings, Montana. A Virginia man was sentenced to 10 years in prison for trying to pay for sex with an underage girl in Montana. From our neighboring state of Nebraska and Lincoln, Nebraska lawmakers seem cool on the idea of giving additional legal protections for poll workers based on First Amendment concerns and whether the new criminal penalties are truly needed. From Reno in Nevada, a Sparks firefighter was untruthful about an altercation with an elderly woman feeding feral cats and used disproportional force by throwing her to the ground, according to an independent investigation. The investigative report authorized by the city came to light after the woman's daughter sued to make it public. From Portsmouth, New Hampshire, the co-chairs of the recently reestablished City Housing Blue Ribbon Committee are committed to developing a below-market rate housing project at the former Sherburne School. In Trenton, New Jersey, even after a big boost in funding in recent years, thousands of New Jersey residents with disabilities are waiting 7 to 10 years to access critical funding for group homes and other support. In Farmington, New Mexico, the long-awaited return of passenger air service to the Four Corners Regional Airport remains locked in a holding pattern, according to airport manager Mike Lewis, but he remains optimistic that a carrier will choose to add flights to and from Farmington sooner rather than later. From Albany, New York, state lawmakers have reintroduced a measure that would allow supermarkets to sell wine. In Wilmington, North Carolina, the chairman of the Pender County Board of Commissioners wants his colleagues to consider creating a new and improved tree ordinance after the removal of hundreds of century-old trees that were in Scotts Hills for years. In Bismarck, North Dakota, roads across the state will have extra patrols this month as authorities crack down on impaired drivers, according to the Bismarck Tribune. From Columbus, Ohio, under a new city code that took effect Friday, most Columbus employees will be prohibited from asking prospective employees how much money they made at their last job, let alone job seekers having to answer. The ban includes all hires at job sites within the city limits that have more than 15 workers and at-home workers employed by firms based in Columbus. And from Oklahoma City, under a new realignment plan proposed by leaders with the United Methodist Church's South Central Jurisdiction, the Oklahoma United Methodist Conference and Oklahoma Indian Missionary Conference would be placed under the leadership of the Reverend Laurel Merrill, the current bishop of the Arkansas United Methodist Conference. Deanna.
Thank you, Pat. Out of Lake Oswego, Oregon, a man is accused of drugging three 12-year-old girls at a sleepover, police say. Police have confirmed that the sleepover was at the man's house. Multiple media outlets are reporting that the man is the father to a girl who was hosting the sleepover, and the girls drugged were his daughter's friends. Out of Erie, Pennsylvania, flu season is slowly winding down in Erie County, but it could set yet another annual record before it's finished. About 28 flu cases a day were reported to the Erie County Department of Health for the week ending February 23rd. The county's lowest seven-day daily average since early December. From Providence, Rhode Island, bucking national and regional trends, the number of farms in Rhode Island and the total area of farmland both grew into the latest federal census of agriculture. From 2017 to 2022, 11 new farms opened in Rhode Island, bringing the total to 1,054, while farmland increased by 4% to 59,076 acres, according to the report recently released by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Out of Greenville, South Carolina, Greenville County Library's Board of Trustees unanimously voted to relocate children's materials depicting transgender minors from the children's section to the parent section, where only adults or minors with library cards allowing them to check out books from any section can access them. Out of Sioux Falls, South Dakota, as Dakota State University celebrates 40 years since it changed its mission from being mainly about teacher education to being more of a STEM university, university leaders are looking back on DSU's progress and envisioning where the university could be 40 years from now. DSU will see advancement in emerging technologies, global leadership in cybersecurity, expansion of learning modes, and global partnerships and collaborations, and will become the entrepreneurial hub of South Dakota's, DSU's president said. Out of Knoxville, Tennessee, the University of Tennessee at Knoxville plans to add 4 future-looking bachelor's degrees that prepare students to work in artificial intelligence, data science, and other emerging fields. Out of Salt Lake City, Utah, the state has submitted its bid to host the 2034 Olympic Winter Games, Utah Public Radio reported. From Burlington, Vermont, school budgets are being dropped from some town meeting day ballots. Out of Richmond, Virginia, Hopewell is pushing back against an amendment to proposed legislation that would limit the scope of so-called fiscally distressed localities affected by the bill to Central Virginia. From Bremerton, Washington, Great Peninsula Conservancy acquired 183 acres of property along the Tuyua River last year and is working with the Hood Canal Salmon Enhancement Group on plans to remove the gabion wall. Eventually, they will restore the floodplain and allow salmon and other wildlife to explore habitat there again. From Harpers Ferry, West Virginia, staff and volunteers at Harpers Ferry National Historic Park are looking forward to another peregrine falcon nesting season on the bluffs of Maryland Heights. To provide the peregrines with the conditions they need to raise chicks, the park has again closed portions of Maryland Heights, which will be in effect through July 31st. Out of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, one of the last pieces in a sweeping deal between the University of Wisconsin system and the state legislature was approved, moving campuses one step closer to the end of an extended and contentious state budget session. The GOP-controlled Budget Writing Committee has released $32 million to UW system, the same amount it had withheld from UW's budget 8 months earlier as part of a broader campaign against campus diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts. And finally, at the end of the alphabet, Jackson, Wyoming. Officials said Teton County's administrator has resigned and her last day will be on March 15th, according to the Jackson Hole News. Pat.
Thank you, Deanna. And that concludes our 50 state reports. We'll now look at USA Today, and a front page story there says that Miami is trying to break up the spring break party. Rules, restrictions await annual influx in Florida. Kinsey Crowley of USA Today wrote this article. Florida's cold weather is heating up just as schools let out on vacation, and spring breakers will soon be flocking to the Sunshine State. Popular destinations see people head to the beaches in droves, prompting seasonal restrictions for crowd control, many of which went into effect on Friday. But while Fort Lauderdale is welcoming organized fun, Miami Beach wants to break up with spring break. Last year, back-to-back shootings left 2 dead and brought unruly crowds to the streets, prompting a state of emergency around the state. Whether March tourists are a welcome sight or dreaded, emergency officials are bracing for what's to come. In 2021, Miami Beach made more than 1,000 arrests among spring breakers, leading them to issue an emergency curfew. In 2022, 2 shootings injured 5 people, leading to another curfew. Last year, the Miami Beach Police Department said it conducted 488 arrests, impounded 105 firearms, and issued 7,190 traffic citations between February 27th and March 27th. This year, they said enough is enough. The city is imposing additional security every Thursday through Sunday in March, limiting beach access and closing liquor stores early. From March 7th through the 10th and March 14th through the 17th, the city will close parking garages in South Beach. We're breaking up with spring break, the Miami Beach website states. Expect curfews, security searches, and bag checks at beach access points, early beach entrance closures, DUI checkpoints, bumper-to-bumper traffic, road closures, and arrests for drug possession and violence. Fort Lauderdale mayor says the city is embracing spring breakers. Contrary to Miami Beach, Fort Lauderdale Mayor Dean Trantelis told USA Today the city is embracing spring break, welcoming tourists to enjoy the entertainment, beaches, and restaurants. But the city's relationship with the holiday wasn't always so harmonious. Trantelis said in the 1970s and 1980s, spring breakers came in hundreds of thousands, overwhelming the city. The mayor said, we had no rules in place, and it really wreaked havoc on our community to the point where it was driving away other visitors and certainly gave investors pause. That chaos led Fort Lauderdale to do the same thing in the early 1980s that Miami Beach is doing this year. Over time, the crowd stopped coming in such large numbers, and restrictions like closing the beach at 5:30 p.m. and mounted patrol on the beach helped to keep things under control these days, according to the mayor. We understand that spring break often brings young people who are looking to have a good time, Trantelis said. As long as you know they maintain a conduct that you know doesn't destroy property, we feel that spring break is a welcome opportunity for Fort Lauderdale to host. Daytona Beach has been known as a destination for spring break partiers for decades, but tourist companies say the crowds have become more family-centric. Some of that young energy may have headed south to near Samarner Beach, where local police have imposed youth curfews for the last couple of years. While the Key West Police Department is increasing police presence with its mounted unit in patrol to enforce laws against drinking alcohol on the beach, spokesperson Allison Crean said they don't put any new rules in place for spring break. Key West does see its share of spring breakers, but nothing like the other Florida areas, Crean said. Okaloosa County Sheriff Eric Aiden warned spring breakers that they would uphold the law in the panhandle. Aiden told Northwest Florida Daily News that we don't want to arrest young people. We want them to come here. We want them to celebrate responsibly, but we also want to set that litmus test and get it out there that they know that there's a zero tolerance policy, and that's pretty much across the entire Emerald Coast from Panama City to Orange Beach, Aiden said. Deanna.
Thank you, Pat. On page 5 of this USA Today, abortion pills are available at CVS and Walgreens. The rollout is to begin within weeks, according to the pharmacies. This is from Adriana Rodriguez. Abortion pills will become available at certain Walgreens and CVS pharmacies in the upcoming weeks. The Food and Drug Administration has allowed the pharmacy chains to provide a prescription medication that initiates an abortion, according to company statements. Excuse me. Walgreens will begin dispensing the drug within a week through a phased rollout, starting with New York, Pennsylvania, Massachusetts, California, and Illinois. The company will not disclose exactly which stores will be dispersing mifepristone, citing safety reasons, but says the goal is to expand to more states where medication abortion is legal. According to the company's statement, Walgreens employees may be able to request an exemption from dispensing mifepristone due to moral, religious, or ethical objections. CVS also recently received FDA certification for the abortion pill and plans to begin dispensing the medication in Massachusetts and Rhode Island in the weeks ahead, expanding to other states on a rolling basis where abortion is legal. According to Planned Parenthood, mifepristone is the first pill prescribed by a doctor to block the progesterone hormone that pregnancy requires. The second medication, misoprostol, is typically taken at home 24 to 48 hours later It causes cramping and bleeding to empty the uterus. Planned Parenthood said medication abortion is an option up to 70 days or 10 weeks after the start of the last period. By day 71, patients can visit a clinic to end a pregnancy in states where abortion is legal. In the past, requirements surrounding mifepristone meant that patients had to pick up their prescriptions at their provider's office. Misoprostol already has been available by prescription in most pharmacies, according to the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. The U.S. Supreme Court is expected to rule in two mifepristone-related cases by June. In one of the cases, the High Court will review an appellate ruling that significantly restricted the use of mifepristone, repealing the FDA's decision to make the drug available through telemedicine and U.S. mail. CVS and Walgreens did not respond to USA Today's questions about whether the pharmacies would make mifepristone prescriptions available for delivery. Pat, back to you.
Thank you, Deanna. And from page 3 in the USA Today, forecast for the hurricane season already is causing concern. Experts see a good chance for a La Nina pattern. Diana Voiles-Pulver wrote this article for USA Today. With 3 months to go until the Atlantic hurricane season starts, the chances for La Nina by summer are increasing, and that's an anxiety-inducing forecast for those still recovering from hurricanes along the Gulf of Mexico and Atlantic seaboard in recent years. Florida State climatologist David Zierden said, "We've got possibly extremely warm sea surface temperatures, especially in the main hurricane development region, and the prospect of La Nina being in place. That's not good news for hurricane season." La Nina is a pattern of cooler waters along the equator in the Pacific Ocean and often leads to more active hurricane seasons. It tends to reduce vertical wind shear over the Atlantic and allow budding tropical storms to build the high cloud structures that can supercharge their energy. Meanwhile, sea surface temperatures in the tropical Atlantic are already running above normal, even warmer than last year. Ocean surface temperatures globally set another new record high, reaching 21.13 degrees Celsius last Wednesday, or just over 70 degrees Fahrenheit, according to the most recent data available through the University of Maine's Climate Reanalyzer, and that's a slight increase above the 21.1 degree record set last April and again last August. The signs are showing a shift from the strong El Niño that has been in place in the Pacific over the past year, said Jason Dunyon, a meteorologist at the University of Miami and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Hurricane Research Division. The bright bands of dark orange on sea surface temperature maps that show El Niño's warmer than normal waters along the equator are fading. The entire El Niño-La Niña cycle is known as the El Niño-Southern Oscillation, and its three phases can affect weather around the world. Whether the oscillation shifts to neutral this summer or to a La Niña is unknown. The latest forecast puts chances for La Niña arriving by the heart of hurricane season at 75% or greater. As a result, Zierden expects the seasonal forecast from Colorado State University and the NOAA to call for a very active season. But the oscillation is far from the only key ingredient in cooking up hurricanes. Warm waters are essential. Well, for the last 90 minutes, your readers have been Deanna Snyder and Pat Steele, and it's been our pleasure to read for you. Now, we will take a short break to allow our next readers, Dale and Doug, to get into place.
Welcome back. Your new readers are Dale Finnegan and Doug Kretzinger. We'll continue with articles from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. And now here's Doug with our first article.
And this one is written by Rex Hupke. You probably know who he is. We read a lot of his. This one is entitled, and he's got a different look at things, Insurrection Must Be A-OK If Trump Is Still on Colorado Ballot. So the Supreme Court ruled in favor of Donald Trump on Monday, affirming what those of us who've studied the Constitution already knew. Each president is entitled to one free insurrection. At issue was Trump's name going on the presidential primary ballot in Colorado. Six voters, four Republicans, and two independents sued to remove him from the state's ballot, claiming that the former president and current criminal defendant had engaged in insurrection, something he quite clearly did, and, by his ongoing denial of the 2020 presidential election results, continues to do to this day. Of course, that belief, confirmed by a Colorado judge who found Trump did engage in insurrection, in quotes, only applies to those who have eyes and ears and saw and listened to everything Trump said and did before, during, and after the insurrection on January 6 of 2021. Trump has been nothing if not insurrection-y. Justices want presidents like Trump to fill their punch cards. But the Supreme Court justices must look at cases through the lens of our Constitution, and somewhere in there, possibly in a footnote or maybe a part that's hard to read due to parchment aging, it clearly says, quote, each president shall be granted one insurrection free of consequences. Any additional insurrections will be considered on a case-by-case basis. Upon the fomenting of a sixth insurrection, the president shall be awarded 1-foot-long turkey and Virginia ham sandwich. I put that in quotes because it was in quotes, but it's certainly not in the Constitution. That makes it understandable why the High Court on Monday unanimously ruled that a single state can't disqualify a presidential candidate. A Civil War-era provision in the 14th Amendment, cited by the Colorado voters, says anyone who previously pledged to support the Constitution as an officer of the United States can't go back into office after engaging in insurrection. Insurrection decisions rest with states, but not abortion rights, question? But it doesn't say who should enforce that provision, so the Supreme Court justices decided that the responsibility rests with Congress and not the states, which is sort of the opposite direction the court took when it came to abortion rights, saying that issue is up to the states and the federal government can pound sand. Those justices sure do keep us on our toes. Given that Congress is about as good at doing things as your average raccoon carcass, Monday's ruling all but affirms Trump has been granted his one free insurrection. The decision means that voters in Colorado and across the country will have the final say on whether Trump deserves a second term and, presumably, a second chance to overthrow the U.S. government and work his way toward that coveted sandwich. The Constitution does not mandate the type of bread, but I believe we can count on the Supreme Court to rule that the Founding Fathers would have wanted a crusty sourdough, with perhaps one dissenting opinion in favor of a hearty wheat. Trump shows he loves nothing more than a good insurrection. Trump has certainly not been shy about his pro-insurrection stance. His rallies now begin with a song recorded by a choir of the January 6 insurrectionist whose devotion to Trump landed them in prison. He continues to baselessly blame the attack on then-House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, whom he at one point confused with his Republican primary rival, Nikki Haley, and he keeps saying there were no guns carried in or around the January 6 attack, which would be true were not utterly false. The good news for Democrats is that President Joe Biden has not yet cashed in on his free insurrection. So if Democrats win full control of Congress in November, and we must rely on Congress and Congress alone to enforce the Constitution, the sky's the limit for Biden. Bring on the gun bans. Rules, what are they really? And who needs them? Well, in arguments before the Supreme Court on behalf of Colorado voters, attorney Jason Murray said, quote, "The reason we're here is that President Trump tried to disenfranchise 80 million Americans who voted against him, and the Constitution doesn't require that he be given another chance," end quote. Yeah, apparently it does. I'm sure the nation's highest court will be much harder on him after the second insurrection, but this one's a freebie. Rules are rules, sort of, written by Rex Hupke.
The second opinion is written by Chris Brennan, who is an elections columnist with USA Today. And the title of his column is "Liberal Voters Won't Let Biden Off the Hook on Super Tuesday." There are two ways to look at last Tuesday's Michigan Democratic primary, when 13% of voters picked uncommitted over President Joe Biden. One, Biden has a serious problem brewing with young progressive voters angry that he has not done more to constrain Israel's military action in the Gaza Strip. Two, that problem received outsized media attention because there is no real Democratic primary contest to focus on, and all those cable news pundits need something to talk about. Both are true, and both are likely to continue as voters cast ballots this week on Super Tuesday. But we don't know yet if protest votes in a primary Biden can't lose will swing the same way in a general election that he could certainly lose to former President Donald Trump. And Trump may be Biden's best ally in all this because the one-termer is still rehashing his selective travel ban on Muslims while shrugging off foreign policy challenges as someone else's problem. Protesters have disrupted Biden's speeches at campaign events this year, drawing attention to the 5 months of violence, death, confusion, and hunger as Palestinians are pushed around an increasingly shattered Gaza Strip by Israel's army. The conflict divides Democrats more than Republicans. A Reuters Ipsos poll released Thursday showed Biden tied with Trump at 36% each in a general election rematch. But it also showed a majority of voters who identified as Democrats being less likely to back a candidate proposing more military assistance to Israel in the aftermath of the October 7th Hamas attacks. That poll landed on a day when more than 100 Palestinians were killed and more than 700 were wounded while waiting in line for food in a conflict with a death toll that has surpassed 30,000, according to the Gaza Health Ministry and Hamas. Larry Sabato, director of University of Virginia's Center for Politics, told me he found news coverage of the Michigan protest vote, quote, overly dramatic, and now is watching to see if other states with options for, quote, uncommitted or no preference, in quotes, see similar impacts. The Michigan effort was well organized, with U.S. Representative Rashida Tlaib, a Palestinian-American Democrat from that state, leading the charge. Biden was slow to shift his rhetoric on what is happening in Gaza, but has stepped up criticism of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. That came too late in Michigan. I think if he had known how Netanyahu was going to handle Gaza, he would have been more careful in his proclamations of support for everything that Netanyahu and Israel did, Sabato said. Will the protest vote carry through to November's general election? Sabato says, I don't think it's going to matter a whole lot. And it's a long time until November, and we will have loads of things that happen that change people's minds one way or another. Democratic voters will cast ballots this week on Super Tuesday in 15 states. That's today. Six of those states offer Democratic primary voters the option, like Michigan, to choose uncommitted slash non-committed or no preference instead of Biden. That could be another headache for the president in North Carolina, the only swing state voting Tuesday. Biden lost North Carolina in 2020 to Trump by fewer than 2 percentage points. He and no preference are the only two ballot options for Democrats in that state Tuesday. Trump leads Biden by 5.7 percentage points in North Carolina in a general election rematch, according to an average of polling compiled by Real Clear Politics. And North Carolina's Democratic voters have sent a primary message before to an incumbent president. President Barack Obama, seeking a second term in 2012, won 79% of the Democratic primary vote that year. But nearly 21% of those voters chose, quote, no preference, instead, the only other option on that primary ballot. In Colorado, Biden faces a non-committed backlash after winning that state in 2020 with 55% of the vote. The Colorado Democratic Party chose to add non-committed as a primary ballot option, even with an incumbent president seeking a second term. Party Chair Shad Murib told the Colorado Sun in December, quote, we aim to provide as many choices as we can to our voters, end quote. The Colorado Palestine Coalition and the Denver chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America have launched a campaign to get voters to go, quote, uncommitted. They're a little late to the game compared with Michigan, but they're fired up all the same and calling for Biden's administration to stop pushing for military aid to Israel. Matt Grossman and David Hopkins co-wrote Asymmetric Politics, Ideological Republicans and Group Interest Democrats. Grossman, a political science professor at Michigan State University, told me that 13% voting uncommitted in Michigan's primary was, quote, enough for a successful protest vote, but not necessarily a demonstration of much for the general election, end quote. He smells some media hype in an otherwise dud of a presidential primary, he says. But there is a political threat to Biden, too, Grossman added, with, quote, plenty of swing Arab American voters who might vote for Trump or a third party in November, but they are mostly people with conservative views on other issues that might be pushed over the edge by Gaza, end quote. Hopkins, a political science professor at Boston College, said the protest vote could come home to the president by November. He says, it seems likely to me that the fall election will be mostly decided by people who aren't voting in the primaries. Biden and Trump easily won their Michigan primaries. Biden touted the state's, quote, diverse coalition, end quote, of voters that helped him defeat Trump there in 2020 and called for more. Trump mocked Biden for losing the city of Dearborn that night to, quote, uncommitted. They'll both win their Super Tuesday primaries as well. Panels of cable news pundits will talk for hours into the evening as if any of this is competitive. Primary season just keeps churning along, even though the outcome is certain. For Biden's potential supporters who are now critics of his approach to Israel and Gaza, that means more platforms for months to ask just how committed they can be. That's an uncomfortable spot for an incumbent. But the critics have to also face an uncomfortable question. If their actions help Trump win, do they think America's foreign policy will improve on this or any other issue? And again, that opinion was from Chris Brennan of the USA Today.
And sports time has arrived. Here's a story from the front page written by Dargan Sellard. Stolke's confidence, energy tending upward at right time is what it reads off the top. The dateline is Iowa City. The postgame assessment after Hannah Stolke delivers one of her staggering stat lines usually reaches the same conclusion. Her head coach has said it. Her position coach has said it. Her Iowa women's basketball teammates certainly hammer it home any chance they get. Let Caitlin Clark take this one. Quote, this is what Hannah's capable of every night, Clark said after Sunday's 93-83 win over number 2 Ohio State. She went on, I think it's just her confidence believing in herself, end quote. With each hard-earned bucket, free throw swish, and defensive stand, Stolke delivers to the delight of Hawkeye fans everywhere. That crucial confidence is strengthening at the exact time it needs to for Iowa to give this memorable campaign an appropriate ending. As the Hawkeyes dial in for the postseason grind up next, one that's guaranteed to feature even more attention and discussion or dissection than they've seen during an emotional regular season, Iowa 26-4 and 15-3 in the Big Ten Conference should feel good about the experiences it's endured and how to reassure those on the roster carrying these March responsibilities for the first time. And that starts with Stolke, who has elevated from complimentary to critical when the basketball tension intensifies. "I think just having confidence in my abilities and in the team," Stolke said, "and not stressing about anything." Sunday offered up more evidence of Stolke's improvement after she and the entire team really rebounded emphatically against Ohio State and forward Cody McMahon following a tough loss in Columbus on January 21. McMahon dominated with 33 points and 12 rebounds that day, relentlessly attacking the interior with a bevy of and is that sparked Ohio State's 100-92 comeback win in overtime. Stolke finished the January 21 game with 10 points on 4-for-12 shooting before fouling out. A split of 2 free throws with Iowa down 1 at the end of regulation generated plenty of toxic dialogue on social media. Sunday, nothing was the same. Riding the Carver-Hawkeye Arena vibe that has been in Stolke's corner all year, the Sterling sophomore made sure there was no repeat effort against the Buckeyes. Her 23 points on 9-for-12 shooting to go with 9 rebounds and a 5-for-8 showing at the line is what the Hawkeyes will need most times moving forward. Her limiting of McMahon, who produced just 10 points on 5-for-11 from the field while getting to the charity stripe only twice, showcased the two-way dominance Stolke can consistently deliver. "I think it was really important to come out like that," Stolke said. She continued to say, "My teammates are really good at getting me the ball, and drawing fouls I think is really fun. That was a lot of fun. It's a tough day for me. I'm a really emotional person. It was great for me to come out and play like that. I think that it's great going up against people who are at the top of league. It's making me better. It's making them better. And I think that's what we all want out of basketball," end quote. Additional signs of confidence were seen well beyond the box score. It's the emphatic fist pump and yell while hopping down the court after Stolke and Kate Martin pulled off a perfect long-range inbounds play to end the first half. The shot didn't count, but still created momentum. I gesture full of sweat and swagger following another hard-earned nose ensuing basket that put Ohio State away late. It's Stolke's wide smile and bubbly personality that continue to shine through more and more each time in front of the post-game mic. Clark is the obvious ringleader of Road Rowdy. But the Hawkeyes are at the best when their passion and fervor permeate the entire Iowa roster. That's the reason why every building the Hawkeyes venture into is full of black and gold support. "Our energy was contagious. I thought Hannah Stolke was really good," Clark said. She continued, "I thought Hannah came up with a lot of big offensive rebounds, especially in the second half. It kind of would get stuck around 10, and Hannah would come up with a big one here and there. I thought she was aggressive, pump-faked a lot, little more, got them in a little more foul trouble. I thought she made some big free throws. She played really, really well, and that's obviously going to be important going down the stretch," end quote. Postseason stretch run officially begins at 5 p.m. Friday at the Big Ten Tournament in Minneapolis, where the number 2 seed Hawkeyes will face the Penn State-Wisconsin winner inside a raucous Target Center. Stolke should be salivating for either matchup, considering she went for a career-high 47 against the Lady Lions on February 8 and 21 at Wisconsin on December 10. That should get Stolke off on the right postseason foot with tougher matchups ahead. Hawkeyes know how much more Stolke can unlock in the weeks ahead. The hope is their declaration of every game domination become reality at the season's most pivotal point.
I will finish up sports with a few things you might want to watch on television. Today, there is some college baseball at 9 p.m. on the Pac-12N station. You can see Stanford at California. And then there are several men's basketball games, men's college basketball games, at 6 p.m. on ACCN. You can catch Notre Dame at North Carolina. On CBSSN, Ohio is at Buffalo. On ESPN, you can watch Alabama at Florida. On ESPN2, Syracuse at Clemson. On FS1 is Providence at Georgetown. And on Peacock, Purdue at Illinois. Those are all 6 p.m. games tonight. There's a lot going on in men's basketball. At 7:30 p.m., there's another men's basketball game on the MWN station. Air Force is at Wyoming. And then a little bit later, at 8 p.m. on ESPN, is Kansas State at Kansas. That's men's basketball. And the final men's basketball game I'll tell you about is on SECN at 8 p.m. That will be Auburn at Missouri. If you are a baseball fan, there is some spring training Major League Baseball. And at noon today, you could watch the spring training game between the New York Yankees and the New York Mets, where they're playing in Port St. Lucie, Florida, and that's on ESPN. And then tonight, another spring training game at 7 p.m. on the MLBN network. That will be the Los Angeles Angels versus the Los Angeles Dodgers, and they're playing in Arizona. There is another headline on the front of the sports page that I will read to you, but I won't have time to get to the article. It's written by Tyler Tuchman, and it indicates that the Iowa men are shooting fewer threes but scoring more. And just a little bit of a first headline, a first paragraph here from Iowa City. Obviously, this is about the University of Iowa men's basketball team. And they mention that in an era of basketball where there is so much emphasis on shooting the three ball, and for a program known for utilizing that part of its arsenal, the men's basketball team is taking fewer long-distance shots this season. And they do note that they are attempting the fewest three-pointers per game and averaging the most points per game. So that's an interesting contrast, apparently change in strategy. It is now time for Dear Abby. The headline of the column, Woman's Failing Health is Wearing Down Family. The first letter says, Dear Abby, my husband speaks to his mom every morning. For the past couple of months, her health has been failing, and she spends most of her days in the hospital, having an extremely tough time. Hearing his mom suffer daily is affecting my husband's mental health. It sets the tone for the whole day, and I spend my mornings trying to cheer him up. How do I tell him these daily conversations with his mom are starting to affect my mornings? Even the dog has begun showing signs of depression. Would I be selfish to suggest he needs to talk to her at a different time or maybe on fewer days? Signed, Bystander in California. Abby says, Dear Bystander, your husband may not have much longer to talk with his very ill mother, so I don't recommend you approach the subject that way. What I do suggest is that you tell your husband how much you love him and that you can see and feel his distress over her condition. Then suggest he talk with a mental health professional who can help him work through this, because you can see how much pain this is causing him. Then cross your fingers and hope he will realize how much he needs it. A second letter says, Dear Abby, I am writing this in the hope that the man of my dreams reads it. I don't know how to approach him. He's getting ready to retire, and I have fallen deeply in love with him as the years have gone by. His personality has always amused me. Sometimes he poses, quote, sexy as a joke, and will often show his belly button. I find him staring at me out of the corner of his eye most days. Please help before it's too late. I'm running out of time. Signed, His Dream Guy in Tennessee. Abby says, Dear Dream Guy, you stated that your dream man is getting ready to retire. I don't think of a better reason for a celebration. I can't think of a better reason for a celebration, she says. Suggest the two of you go out for a drink or a dinner after work so you can toast his upcoming retirement, in quotes. Then cross your fingers that he agrees. It could be the start of something beautiful. A third and final letter says, Dear Abby, my husband suffered a stroke 8 years ago. Everyone thinks he's fine physically and mentally, except those closest to him. We know his brain doesn't function the same. Example, when he went to fill out a job application, he asked me whose name should be put in the applicant field. He occasionally had a short temper, but in recent months he has grown verbally abusive to the point that I'm considering divorcing him. Anything can set him off, and there is no correct reaction from me. I am going to seek counseling. Any other advice for me? Signed, Ready to Leave in Delaware. Dear Ready, I do have one other bit of advice. You stated that, quote, everyone thinks your husband is fine physically and mentally. Are you including his doctors in that statement? Forgetting to put one's own name on a job application and having a recent personality change could be signs of dementia. You should let them know you are worried so he can be evaluated. Well, that brings us to the... Whoops, where are we here? The end of the Des Moines Register for today, Tuesday, March 5th, 2024. I'm Dale Finnegan, and my partner at the microphone has been Doug Kretzinger. Earlier, you heard Deanna Snyder and Pat Steele. You can listen to Iowa's programs on any computer or smart device at any time at our website, iowaradioreading.org. Support for today's readings comes from the Des Moines Register, Iowa Public Radio, Iowa PBS, and bensoundmusic.com. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.